team, but some business came up at their morning conference that delayed us. We are delighted this morning to have with us for this oral argument students from the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater Law Society. I wonder if they would all stand. Good. Thank you very much. It's been a tradition, at least as long as I've been on the bench, which is about 22 years now, that the Whitewater Law Society has come to one oral argument, and then the several members of the court join them for a lunch to discuss the court procedure. Today the lunch is at Costa's, and we will be there, so you may proceed along after the last oral argument of the morning. Now that I've introduced the UW-Whitewater students to the court, I'd like to introduce the court to all of you here. On my left, far left, is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his right is Justice Jeanine Geske. To his right is Justice William Babbage. I guess it's to her right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right is Justice John Wilcox. And on the far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With those preliminary matters completed, we'll go to our case, which is 96-1394 CR, State versus Juan Eugenio. Representing Mr. Eugenio is Eduardo Borda. Good seeing you again, Mr. Borda.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You know, you can drop the podium if you're more comfortable.
No, it's fine.
Okay. I mean, drop it by not pushing the button. Sorry.
I've dealt with podiums and this tall before. I've always been short, so I've gotten accustomed to it.
I know, it's the podium that's tall. That's you. All right. What do you got to say for Mr. Eugenio?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Ed Borda appears on behalf of Juan Eugenio. He is, in this case, a defendant, the appellant, and the petitioner. Juan Eugenio was convicted of sexual assault of a child, a six-year-old child. The defendant had been charged and convicted of that particular count, another charge of threat to witness was not found to be appropriate by the jury in his case. And during the course of the trial, many things occurred, including what we believe to be impermissible or improper bolstering of the child victim by a ruling made by the trial court. And it revolves around the victim-supportive character evidence for truthfulness. In this case, what occurred is that the facts of the case, only insofar that it's pertinent at this time, that this is a weak case from the perspective that there was no scientific evidence, there was no corroborating evidence that there was any untoward touching of the child, there was no medical evidence. It boiled down to the statement of a six-year-old child versus the statement of the defendant. The defendant took the witness stand, and as did the child, of course, and ultimately, based on some questions that were asked of the victim in the case, the court determined that the victim's character had been attacked, and as a result, the court allowed then the statement from a child counselor, a school counselor, who took the witness stand and stated that it was her belief that the child is truthful and that the child has truthful character. So you have a case where the evidence is thin. However, based on what Eugenio believes to have been improper bolstering on the part of the counselor, the jury came back and determined that Eugenio was involved in the assault itself. The question that we have before the court now with respect to this particular issue is whether or not there appears to be a conflict with the test that was used by the court. And the conflict in the test, it is spelled out in this way. The court used the case of Anderson. In Anderson, the test is such that depending on the type of examination that's made, the tenor of the examination, that the court, under those circumstances, can deem that it's tantamount to an accusation that a witness is lying. Now, that is an attack, essentially, on the credibility of a witness. That is not an attack on the character of the witness. In fact, in Anderson, the court gave this as the rationale. The mere fact that a witness is contradicted does not constitute an attack on the witness's character. So although the court gives us this particular rationale, that is, the Anderson court gives us this rationale, the testing procedure is one where, as an example, if a defense lawyer would say, isn't it a fact that A, B, and C, and the defense lawyer would point and would use that particular tone with a witness, under those particular circumstances, according to Anderson, that would be enough then to claim that there's an attack on the witness's character for truthfulness. And that is not so. Anderson essentially allows rehabilitative character evidence in virtually all cases if we are to follow that test, because an aggressive cross-examiner will, of course, use the standard engine of truth, isn't it a fact that A, B, C? And under the circumstances, if we are to continue using this particular standard, what we will be doing is telling lawyers in our community, in our state, that we should focus in on the credibility of the witness and not on the witness's character.
Mr. Boyer, let me tell you what my problem is. I don't see the difference, frankly, between attacking the witness's character for truthfulness and attacking the witness's credibility. Credibility means you don't believe them. You don't believe them because they're not truthful. So, it seems to me, even if you can take the two far extremes, they slide into each other very quickly. So, what do you say about that?
Well, what we have to deal with is whether or not there's been attack on the general character of a person, the general character of the witness, whether there's a difference between attacking the credibility of the witness with respect to the instant and pending charge versus is that person corrupt, is that person untruthful always. If that's the situation, then character evidence should be allowed, and the statute allows for that.
So what did you do here?
I'm sorry?
What did the trial lawyer do here?
The trial lawyer, from what we gather from the transcript, simply said that the witness's own statement essentially attacked her credibility and argued that it wasn't necessarily character evidence. In this case, what had occurred is that...
Didn't he just, let me correct you, I understood that after using that example in the opening statement, he then said that he mentioned her lying. In other words, he gave these examples and then specifically indicated that this is indicative of a person who doesn't tell the truth or would be lying.
It was the questioner attacked the credibility of the witness as it related only to the instant offense. Did not attack that person's credibility with respect, does she always lie? Does she know the difference between what a monkey looks like and what a mule looks like? It wasn't in that vein at all. Essentially what it was is an opening statement. The questioner, in this case it would have been the public defender, made a statement to the jury that what you're going to hear is inconsistencies coming from the witness. That's not uncommon. In fact, that is found in probably every single case, both criminal and civil.
Mr. Borna, didn't the opening statement involve some statements to the effect that the young girl involved had low self-esteem and that would be one of the reasons why she would give a false story? Isn't that an attack on character for truthfulness?
I believe not. I believe that there are a great many people that receive services. For example, she received services from a counselor at school. There's a great many people that receive services from counselors, but because they receive services from counselors doesn't mean that their character for truthfulness has been attacked. It simply meant, under the circumstances, she was receiving some type of treatment, and, in fact, it was opened up, the door was opened by the prosecutor and not by the defense in the case. And when the defense brought it to the court, to the jury's attention, it was strictly for the purpose of alerting the jury that in this instant case, we have to examine whether or not this particular victim has lied as to this case. Not because the victim in the past has lied with respect to other things. Again, I go back to my example. Does she know the difference between a monkey and a mule? Has she lied about things of that nature? But rather that it was simply as it relates to the instance that dealt with the untoward touching. Because during the course of the trial, there was some question regarding what was the type of touching. Sometimes it was a brushing against the area of the vagina. Sometimes it was the actual touching where, according to the victim, she could feel blood rushing. Sometimes it was a different story. And so, but it all related back to the instant offense,
Let me explore this with you a little bit. I mean, I certainly can see situations on cross-examination where you are trying to attack the credibility of a witness, and you're doing it by means of attacking on memory, attacking on ability to see and perception and those kinds of things. I think everybody here would agree that that is not an attack on the character for truthfulness, and yet it is an attack on credibility. In a case where there is some cross-examination and at least there were statements, an opening statement here, maybe some cross-examination on whether or not the witness is lying here, I think is maybe where we're at. If you call someone a liar in this case, is that an attack on character, on their character for truthfulness? As I hear your argument, and I want to make sure I'm hearing it correctly, your position is, in order to meet the requirements of an attack on character for truthfulness, there has to be an attack for truthfulness on something else outside of the events of this case. So it has to be either that you generally are a liar, or that you've got a reputation for being a liar, or that in someone else's opinion you're generally a liar, but it has to relate to facts outside of the case. Is that your position?
That's correct, and in fact, that's what 90608 spells out, and that's where Anderson does not fall in line with the legislative intent of that particular statute. In 90608, a witness's credibility may be attacked by reputation or opinion evidence, but only after the witness's truthful character has been attacked. And if we are to say that each time a questioner attacks a particular witness's credibility at trial, that then should allow the door to open up to two or three or more witnesses to come in and say, that witness is as truthful as the day is long. Not only will we have some difficulties with respect to length of trials, but certainly we're going to have some real problems with respect to each and every one of those cases will probably arrive back at this court, because those attorneys that bring the matters up on appeal will question the wisdom of Anderson when you compare it against 90608.
Let me ask you one follow-up question. So your reading of Anderson, and there are some, I think there's some subsequent Court of Appeals opinions, is that once there is a vigorous cross-examination of a witness with the insinuation, at least by the questioning, that the witness is lying here, that then the side who called that witness can then call at least some witnesses or parade of witnesses who will simply offer as opinions that their reputation for that witness in the community is one of truthfulness, or in the alternative, a parade of witnesses will say, I've known this person for a long time and I believe that they are a character for truthfulness, without commenting on the events at all of the case.
That's correct. And the danger with that is, as we see in this case, between the time that the event occurred and the actual reporting was approximately 4 years. There's no physical evidence, there's no scientific evidence, as I stated before. Essentially, it's the word of a six-year-old versus a grown man. But you bring in now, with this character evidence witness, a school counselor who deals with children, although our reading shows that the person was never found to be an expert in the mind of the juror. The juror sees this person, this counselor that deals with children, that dealt with this girl, take the witness stand and say, in summary, that girl tells the truth. And therefore, the jury is led to believe that because you have these two witnesses, the victim and, of course, the corroborating witness that says this victim always tells the truth, they're left in a situation where they will necessarily convict the defendant, and that is improper bolstering. And that is what occurred in this particular case. And that is what Eugenio has argued. The question then becomes, what do we do when we have a problem, as I've stated, this conflict between 90608 and the test that's been enunciated in Anderson? The admissibility standard, in my opinion, as I've indicated in writing now, is that the court should look to U.S. versus Dring. And in that particular case, the U.S. Court of Appeals had to interpret the Federal Rules of Evidence 608A2, which is similar to 90608. And what that comes down to is that attacks on the truthfulness, not merely attacks on truthfulness, triggers rehabilitation, but rather attacks on the witness's prior history or general character for truthfulness. In fact, it's a stricter standard. It's a stricter test. It protects where Anderson does not. Anderson is a problem because Anderson provides us with a rationale, and then the test flies in the face of the actual rationale. And when we look to the Dring Court, the focus is on whether the witness's general character has been attacked, as opposed to a mere implication that a witness may be lying on a single occasion.
Would you address, because I understand at least from your brief, I think you're addressing that there may, even if Anderson were applied, that there may be a problem here in terms of the cross-examination. Is that your position? I know that if you take away the opening statement, and the fact that the opening statement's not evidence, and you apply the Anderson test, is it your belief that there was sufficient cross-examination, if Anderson were to be applied, in order to allow, open the door to a character evidence?
No. And the reason I say that is because, and it's been mentioned in other cases, in this case, if the court truly believed that there had been an attack made based on the tenor and the tone of the cross-examiner and through the gestures, then that should have been stated. Because then if the rule is to be tantamount to an accusation that a witness is lying, in the transcript it should reveal that the trial court mentioned that the defense attorney was throwing his finger at the victim, throwing his finger at the defense, yelling at the top of his voice, isn't it a fact, A, B, C. But those things aren't mentioned at all. Essentially, it was a very cursory review. The court decided that under the circumstances, maybe the court felt that the case was a weak case. Maybe the court felt that under the circumstances you needed some bolstering so that there would be a greater likelihood of conviction. That's the problem. We don't know unless the court spells it out in the transcript, and the court did not do that.
Did the counselor testify to anything else?
I'm sorry?
Did the counselor testify to anything else?
The counselor testified to the accounts that were given to her by the victim, but with respect to this particular issue concerning the supportive character evidence for truthfulness, very briefly.
So this witness both testified, was both a factual witness in terms of accounts of the sexual assault and a character witness in terms of saying that she thinks that this particular, that the victim in this case is a credible person or truthful person? Was there any objection to the risk? Because clearly the case law says that a character witness cannot offer an opinion that they believe the truthfulness of another witness in the case. Was there any objection to piggybacking those two kinds of testimony side by side, the risk that the jury was going to conclude that what the witness was in fact saying was that she believed her in this case?
Well, apparently there wasn't too much of a concern, because later on then they also allow the entire statement to come in because the judge at the trial level decided to use the rule of completeness.
So was this on cross-examination that witness was asked about the prior statements?
Yes.
Oh, so it was not the state that offered the witness. The state only offered the witness for the character?
No, the state had offered the witness, and then during the course of cross-examination, the examiner then started going through what the examiner thought were inconsistencies.
So it was the defense that raised it with this witness as a fact witness?
That's correct. And then ultimately what occurred, which was another issue that was brought to the court's attention, was concerning the rule of completeness. And the court decided
that. I think it was here that the state argues that if it's error, it's harmless. I mean, it just took a couple of lines of testimony and as to the character.
Okay. And my response to that is that You have a weak case. You have a six-year-old child. There's nothing else, in our opinion, other than the credibility factor of the defendant versus the six-year-old child. One cannot say it was not of great consequence when you take a school counselor and she testifies as to the truthfulness of the victim's character. Under those circumstances, it's no longer harmless error, because when we look at the case of State versus Dias, there is a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the conviction, because without that improper bolstering, in our opinion, the jury would have been left with a great many inconsistencies by this particular child victim. That, in conjunction with all the other factors that the jury would have considered, the vintage of the case was already about 4 years old once it was reported, the fact that there's no corroboration, the fact that it hadn't been, that there's no physical evidence, no scientific evidence of any kind. And under those circumstances, it's clear that there is a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the conviction of Mr. Eugenio. Furthermore, during the course of the trial, there had been a motion that was filed by the defense attorney in the case dealing with what the defense attorney believed to have been prosecutorial misconduct. And essentially what occurred is that the defense attorney's investigator wanted to talk to the child victim to try to develop their case, to try to determine if there was more out there other than what had been provided. And in this case, the mother of the victim determined that somehow it appeared to her that the investigator simply wanted to mess up her daughter by asking questions. The prosecutor did absolutely nothing to dissuade her from that particular belief, from that particular misconception. And we turn to State versus Simmons, a Wisconsin Supreme Court case from 1973, and this court relied heavily in the Simmons matter with respect to the prosecutor's duty to encourage a victim's accessibility or a witness's accessibility. And although it's true, and we would concede that the court never formally adopted the commentary, we believe that it's persuasive authority in this case. The prosecutor should have a duty to encourage witnesses to make themselves available and not simply to remain neutral, not to leave the person believing that the defense is only there to mess up or harm the case. And in this case, we deal with the American Bar Association standards, and although the ABA standards 3.1 sub C was the only portion of the standard adopted by Simmons, the commentary was cited at length. The commentary is instructive in terms of what should be done. And really, the crux, in a nutshell, what the commentary says is that both counsel, the prosecutor and the defense, they should both work in the interest of justice. What is so difficult about telling a witness it's in the interest of justice to talk to the other side? And in this case, apparently, the state's contention is simply because a prosecutor omits to do something, that's not the same thing as the prosecutor trying to discourage something.
Well, but Mr. Borda, those comments have been amended, have they not?
That's correct. Comments.
Do you view the amendment to the comments as indicating that the prosecutor has some affirmative duty to encourage the witnesses?
No, I believe that the commentary back in 71 and the commentary again back in 1993, they're substantially the same. They've become neutral in terms of gender, and the interest of justice language is still present. And it still discusses that both counsel have a duty and an obligation to seek out witnesses, and clearly from that language, in both the 1971 commentary and the 1993 commentary, that the interest of justice is first and foremost. We are not combatants. We are not gladiators. That's not the point. According to the ABA standard on the prosecution function, we should work together, because by working together, we are going for the common goal, and the common goal is for the search for the truth.
Is there any indication of prosecutor here discouraging the mother from cooperating with the defense?
No, there was no overt discouraging. There was nothing here to demonstrate that the prosecutor says, look, ma'am, don't talk to them because they're bums. Nothing like that occurred. But what did occur is that the woman says, well, I guess my daughter's going to get all messed up because she's going to talk to the investigator. Obviously, messing up means that her daughter's going to be harmed. The prosecutor in the case did nothing. He omitted his obligation. Under the circumstance, he should have said, in the interest of justice, you can talk to them. You can have your daughter talk.
Why should a prosecutor be required to go the extra step? The state concedes that access to witnesses in the interest of justice. The fact situation, as you portray it, is the parent, the mother, thinking that the daughter is going to be messed up by talking with the defense attorney. Where is there authority that the state has the obligation to affirmatively advise that it is in the interest of justice and affirmatively encourage?
There is no case on point. That's absolutely correct. But before slavery was abolished, it was believed that slavery would go on forever.
I mean, this is perhaps not a studied response, but if it is not an unreasonable response for a mother to say, emphatically say, there is no way that a defense attorney is going to be talking to my six-year-old daughter, and then the prosecutor is supposed to champion and confront her on that and champion the cause of accessibility. It doesn't make a lot. I'm not sure it's compelling to me. What can you say?
I think what's more compelling is the purpose of what our system is about. The purpose of our system, and I see my time is up, but the purpose of our system, whether it's a civil case or a criminal case, is a search for the truth. And if someone takes offense at the statement that it would be in the interest of justice for you to speak to the investigator, but you need not to, if that is going to be some type of an insult, then I guess we're all in the wrong business. Because if we are dealing with the interest of justice, and if the purpose is to ferret out the truth, then let's do that. And the same standard that would apply to a prosecutor, for example, should be the same standard that applies to a defense attorney. You have obligation. As a lawyer in this state, in this country, to make certain that we ferret out the truth. And under the circumstances, I believe that the commentary to the ABA standards is appropriate, and I would ask the court to adopt that commentary and make that a standard that should be applied in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Boetta. Mr. Munson, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice, members of the court. I guess I'll start with the issue you just finished on to keep a train of thought. The most striking thing about that discussion to me was that the investigator was present during this conversation with the mother. When the mother said, you're here, I guess, essentially she concluded the investigator was there to mess up her daughter. Those words could mean a lot of things. It could mean that the mother could simply have been correctly perceiving that the investigator was there to see if he couldn't pick up on any inconsistent statements that would be used against the daughter. I mean, that's one way of messing up the daughter. It's striking to me that the investigator who was present didn't correct her misperception. I think that he perceived that it was his job to be there to undercut her credibility. He was there representing the defendant. The child was accusing him of sexual assault. I never suggested in my brief, and I don't suggest, that there's anything improper with the investigator trying to talk to this girl, trying to undercut her credibility some way. There's nothing wrong with that. And when the mother...
By undercutting, you mean trying to find out if there are inconsistent statements. You don't mean that he's going to try and somehow persuade her as to different facts, do you?
Right. Or traumatize her.
Right.
I mean,
you're not suggesting that. Okay.
The mother, on the other hand, may have perceived that it would have the effect of messing up her daughter. I mean, the repeated questioning. She expressed a concern that her daughter had been subjected to repeated questioning. And in fact, the defense attorney had already questioned this child at the preliminary hearing. So, getting back to the commentary that you were asking about that had been changed, I think it was changed because there was a recognition that it is not always in the interest of justice that a witness submit to an interview. You know, an obvious example might be a sex offender who's representing himself. I mean, I don't think you ought to subject a young child to questioning by the very person who has sexually assaulted them. But in this case, too, I honestly don't know if it was in the interest of justice. Here we have a child who is already questioned by the defense attorney. We have a mother who is concerned about the repeated questioning of the child. Why was it in the interest of justice for this child to be questioned yet a second time by the defense? I'm not sure that it was. I think that if you read the change in the commentary, the 1993 change in the commentary, they really did change the meaning of the sentence, meaning of that commentary. They took a sentence that said exactly what the defense wants to be the rule here, and they cut it in half. They severed the requirement that you affirmatively inform a witness that they have, in effect, sort of a duty, that's in the interest of justice to cooperate. They severed that affirmative requirement from the beginning of the sentence, the part of the sentence dealing with the situation you have. What do you do when a witness asks you whether they should cooperate with the defense? Those two were severed. And the other thing that I want to point out is that...
Tell me what the state's position is. I mean, we ultimately have to write an opinion. We could debate as to whether we adopted the commentary, but somewhere down the line we're going to have to say what the state's obligation is, right? When a witness asks the very question you were about to ask, I got a call from defense counsel or the defense team or a defense investigator, and he wants me, my child, whatever, to talk with him or her. Now, what's the state's obligation as you see it? What does
first,
the district attorney have to say, should say?
Their obligation, first and foremost, is to be truthful, to honestly relate what information they have. In this case, it's a really good example of a prosecutor...
So you expect the district attorney to say to the person, you should be truthful and honestly relate all the information when you speak to the defense counsel, right?
No, I was saying that the prosecutor himself needs to be truthful about what he says to the...
Okay.
He or she says
so
to
what's
the...
So what's being truthful?
Being truthful, I think, is laying out their options.
What are their options?
The option would be to meet with a defense attorney, with a prosecutor or someone from the police department or someone else present, or to decline to meet with that person, with the investigator.
Well, and then the witness says, the easiest thing is to just decline to meet. Is that what I should do? What does the district attorney say next?
That's your decision.
Do you see any difference, sir, between here we have a victim? I mean, I was thinking, well, if you're going to be, you've already had a preliminary examination, there's been extensive questioning, as I understand it, of the victim by the defense counsel. I'm just thinking of a sense of fairness and fair play. If we have a victim and we have an accused defendant, there has to be, and Mr. Borda brought this up when he indicated, well, we're not gladiators, but basically there is some conflict here. There's some confrontation. It'd be no different, although I'm not suggesting this, that the prosecution would have a chance to interview the defendant. And I'm just thinking of the policy implications here of what we're really looking at. And what you're saying, if I understand, is that the district attorney at least has to be neutral. There's an obligation for him or her to be truthful. And the division here seems to be whether you would actively encourage. Is that what you see no obligation to actively encourage the
witness?
I guess I'm seeing a difference. Is there a difference between this is the victim as some other witness that you may have that they want to talk to?
No, I don't think there should be any different obligation on the prosecutor's part, whether it's a victim or any other witness. I think it should be the same. They should have the obligation to honestly tell them what their options are. Okay. I think there's...
So that's a standard you're suggesting with this court?
Yes. I think there's a danger in requiring the prosecutors use this sort of language to encourage witnesses to cooperate. The danger is that, again, we're dealing with witnesses who don't know much about the system. If you take the language of this, of the commentary, and you end up saying to your witness, I've given you your options, but I need to tell you it's in the interest of justice you make yourself available for an interview by the defendant or his representative, I think that makes it sound to a lot of people like they have a duty. I mean, it's easy for a witness to misinterpret that.
Don't you think they do?
Pardon me?
Don't you think they do? I mean,
have a duty?
Well, let's put it this way. Okay, I got you through where you give me three options. I'm the witness. And then I say to you, well, what do you think I should do? And you say to me, that's your decision. So I say to you, and that's the end, that could be the end of the conversation, and that's okay, right? Okay, but I'm a little concerned about all this. So I say to you, well, the easiest thing for me is just not to do that. Then I'm not subject to being questioned. I don't kill an hour or two or whatever it is in the office. So, I mean, that's the easiest thing. So give me the pros and cons of testifying. I mean, why should I do it? Why should I meet with them?
I don't think a prosecutor ought to engage in that sort of exchange. I think the prosecutor's job...
You're going to tell me I'm not going to engage in that kind of exchange with you. I've given you your three options. It's your job to decide what you want to do. If you need more information, go to the victim witness group. Maybe you wouldn't say that. I mean, you would just say, hey, look, I've given you three options. I can't tell you anymore. I don't want to tell you anymore. It's not my job to tell you anymore. What are you going to say? I'm pushing you a little as the witness.
I think in real-life situations where you're having a conversation with a person,
right,
there's going to be a temptation on the part of prosecutors to, you know, not do anything to encourage a victim to cooperate with
them. Why not? You're not the other. I mean, I've heard Mike McCann give this speech, and I think he's forthright, and he gives it to his own DAs. You're not in there to convict. You're not in there to run a record. You're not in there to rack them up. You're there to do justice. And you're there to handle that. And he opens up his files and says, hey, look, I think I got a case. I can do it beyond a reasonable doubt. But that my job is to be sure that that's right. And I'm going to give this to you. So what do you mean that's not your job? That's the essence of this case, isn't it?
I agree with you. And I think that what I draw from that is that it is critical that prosecutors honestly not discourage people from talking with the defense.
But
very honestly follow that obligation. Because it is completely improper for them to subtly dissuade them in whatever ways they might by emphasizing the downsides and minimizing the upsides. That's
so if you were writing with respect to this area, you would say that it is the duty of that the prosecutor must not in any manner discourage the interview from the interview.
Yes, I agree completely.
But if you won't answer my question, then you would say that's not discouraging. So I ask you, what are the pros and cons of meeting them? And you say, I'm not going to discuss that with you. You don't think that's discouraging?
I think, again, you know, I'd have to say there's a thousand ways that this kind of conversation could take place. I think if the prosecutor has it in mind that they're to lay out accurate information, tell them what their options are, honestly, I think that you give that witness what they need to make their own decision.
Isn't one of the problems that if you start discussing the pros and cons of the witness talking to the lawyer, that in fact you may be dissuading them? Because the con of them talking is that they are giving information that may be used in cross-examination, may be used to show that they're lying or inconsistent. I mean, it seems to me that in terms of a witness's best interest, okay, it is not to talk to somebody who may be cross-examining them later on.
Isn't there that risk
that, in fact, you may be dissuading them by virtue of advising them what may occur if they, in fact, sit down and talk?
But that's based on reality. I mean, defense attorneys advise their defendants not to talk to the police because they view it to be in their best interest.
They have a constitutional right, counsel.
Exactly. I mean, but it's also even...
Witness does not.
Pardon me?
A witness does not have a constitutional right.
But the rule that the defendant is arguing for would apply in all cases. Essentially, they're saying in all cases, the prosecutor has an obligation to tell a victim that it's in the interest of justice that they participate.
Well, what's the matter with saying you've got three options, and that it's in the interest of justice to participate, if you believe that? Do you believe that? You think it's in the interest of justice to participate?
For a witness to always submit to a defense interview?
Yeah.
It's not always, no.
Okay, well then you just disagree with the commentary, too.
No, not with the present commentary.
No, with the
present
past.
Commentary says in most cases, the present commentary has qualified that language to indicate that in most cases it's in the interest of justice.
Or do you believe in most cases it's in the interest of justice?
I think in most cases it is in the interest of justice for witnesses to submit to a defense interview.
So are you willing to say that that's what the prosecutor should say? Should say, here are your three options, and then just say the words, in most cases, it's in the interest of justice to participate.
No, because I don't think it's in the interest of justice in every case, and I don't think prosecutors should get involved in trying to decide when it's in the interest of justice and when it isn't. I don't think it's a prosecutor's decision to make that call.
Is it in the interest of most witnesses and victims to cooperate?
In their own interest?
Yes.
Well, I mean,
I don't think it's really consistent.
Who believes that they have been, victimized by the defendant.
The reason I ask the question is it seems to me the prosecutor is in a bit of a dilemma when they start talking, because if the prosecutor believes, I think as the standard indicates, that in fact it's in the interest of justice that the victim or the witnesses cooperate, that's one thing. But in terms of answering questions as to what the victim may see as his or her best interest, in fact, it may not be to the witness's best interest in terms of what may ultimately happen in the courtroom and how they may be treated in cross-examination. So it seems to me that there's a friction between those two when the witness starts asking questions.
And that's why the decision should be left to the victim. Exactly, because the victim has different interests. It's their right. It is their right not to participate. And when a prosecutor gets involved in telling them that they have, essentially it's in the interest of justice, they have, implicitly a sort of duty to cooperate, I think he's telling them something that may compel them to do something that's not in their own best interest, that may mislead them about what their rights are and their role in the process.
Can I draw you off into the Anderson case a little bit?
I would love to go back to that because...
Let me tell you my concerns. If you look at 90806 before the Anderson case, and I would think, and having been a trial judge, I would think that most people would have interpreted that statute to say that generally if there is an attack on character for evidence, which to me is broader than simply vigorous cross-examination on a particular case, in order to be able to call these witnesses, now character witnesses for truthfulness and untruthfulness have minimal probative value, I think is sort of the general view, and you don't see them very often in criminal cases, partly because of the cross-examination that can occur. But it seems to me that Anderson, and there are a couple of subsequent Court of Appeals opinions that I didn't see in either of the briefs, that seem to have narrowed, or broad, depending on your perspective, 90608. And in fact, there's a case, State v. Rochelt, it's R-O-C-H-E-L-T at 165 Wisconsin, where the court, although it doesn't cite, the Court of Appeals did not cite Anderson, said that evidence attacking the credibility of a witness is an attack on the character of the witness for truthfulness or untruthfulness. It seems to me that saying it's not an attack on the character, it's an attack on credibility is all you need. What is the state's view on that?
The state's view is that when you use labels like credibility and character, you're not really addressing the fundamental question. I mean, I'm not sure when someone says character is being attacked or credibility is being attacked, excuse me, I'm not sure what they're talking about. But
well,
what I can...
for a character witness, for example, on an opinion, let's forget the reputation. A character witness, it's not whether anybody has ever lied in their lives. I mean, I think most people, you're going to find under some given circumstances, they've not been truthful. But character evidence, at least to me, has always been, you know, are they a truthful person or are they known as a liar? I mean, and there are a lot of people that maybe aren't known as either. They're somewhere in between. But for people to offer an opinion as to truthfulness, that means generally my experience with them has been that they're a truthful person. That doesn't mean that they aren't lying here or lying there. But it seems to me that an attack on credibility in a given case is... can be simply that they are lying here as opposed to they generally lie. They don't care about the truth. They lie all the time. And it seems to me those are two different things. And what the Court of Appeals seems to have done with Anderson and subsequent cases is say they are the same. That if you're lying here, that in fact you're saying that their character is one of a liar. And therefore you can rebut that by bringing in a character witness for truthfulness.
Okay. I think that Anderson is defensible for the reason that it provides a simple-to-use bright-line rule, and because you're dealing with underlying evidence that isn't
a bright-line rule that if it's attack on credibility, that's enough?
Okay, but what I want to switch focus on is how you tell the difference between an attack that is case-specific and one that's an attack on character. You can't do it with labels. You can't do it by saying it's attack on credibility or it's attack on bias. You have to look at what's going on in a particular case. Is it really an attack that's specific to this case? Take the example of the mother who is testifying giving her son, who is charged with a serious crime, an alibi. So that's the witness you're talking about. The state wants to undercut her testimony and is alleging that she's lying to protect her son. The defense, now, so there you have the issue. Now, is that an attack in the specific case, or is that attacking her general credibility? I contend that's an attack. That's saying that in this particular case, this witness, this mother, has a compelling reason to lie.
So your position is that the defense in that case could not call a character untruthfulness.
True. Okay. I'm saying that. And I'm saying that because she might...
So you disagree with the statement that I read to you from this Court of Appeals opinion? I know I'm reading it out of context.
I'm saying I don't know what that means. I'm saying that that kind of statement doesn't provide any guidance to a judge who's trying to make a real-life decision.
Okay.
And the best way to try to pick out the difference between when you have a case-specific attack and when you have something that's more general is talking about examples. And when I'm talking about the mother example, it's really instructive because suppose in that case the prosecutor wanted to support her testimony with character evidence. And the judge erroneously allowed the defense to do that. The prosecutor doesn't really care because he's not saying the mother is generally a liar. He's saying, my God, her son is on trial facing a long prison term. She has a compelling reason to lie in this case.
Well, the prosecutor may mind if they call the mayor of the city or the archbishop or someone else that says, this mother, I know her and I've known her for 50 years, and my opinion is she's a truthful person. The prosecutor may in fact care.
Well, he may care, but think about it. If the prosecutor isn't attacking her general character for truthfulness, if he isn't saying that she generally is a liar, then the evidence that she is generally truthful is superfluous. He shouldn't care whether the mayor gets up there. Now, because it cuts to the heart of what's at issue. If this is a Trojan horse, if the prosecutor is trying to do both, to say that she's lying in this particular case, and, oh, I wouldn't care, jury, if you also believe that she's generally a liar, then, you know, then he sort of gets his due.
Okay,
if this evidence
comes in this case.
Pardon me?
How on this case is, forgetting the opening statement
for a moment. I hope that doesn't indicate any concern.
No, I want to talk about in terms of what happened at trial, the evidence as opposed to the opening statement.
Well, the way you attack credibility isn't through evidence. The way you attack credibility is through how you question witnesses. Whether you, it's not
where
typically...
Where do you see that in the rule?
The rule talks about
evidence, right?
Attack on character through, let me turn to the...
It says, evidence of truthful character is admissible only after the character of the witness for truthfulness has been attacked by opinion or reputation evidence or otherwise.
Or otherwise. And the otherwise is a big part of that statement.
So you think otherwise, it means things other than evidence, or does it mean things other than opinion and reputation evidence?
No, it means things other than evidence, and in case after case after case, the attack on the victim's character comes through questioning or opening statements. So that is the most common way to attack character is through your cross-examination, the questions that you ask.
Case after case in Wisconsin, other than Anderson?
Well, I don't know how many cases in Wisconsin. I've got a lot of issues going on this morning, so I'm kind of a little...
Okay, all right.
But I cite several in my brief. So I think that if you look at this area, you will see that whether it's an attack in opening statement or through cross-examination, that is a valid way to attack character.
Mr. Lundstrom, continuing along the line, and maybe Justice Kennedy, if that's okay.
Yeah.
You used the example of mom, and you would say that that does not constitute an attack on character, and therefore mom cannot be buttressed, correct?
That's a case-specific attack.
But what about here with the victim? Now, why is... Are you saying that this is not a case-specific attack?
Yes.
And why is that?
In this case, there was no allegation that this victim had a grudge against Mr. Eugenio. There was no allegation that he mistreated her and she had some reason to lie against him. There was nothing case-specific about this at all. They were saying that this child liked the attention she got when she told about this assault, that she got attention for lying. But when you think about it, I mean, it shows the folly of sort of looking at it simplistically. You know, it certainly was an attack sort of within the facts of this case. But when you think about it, there was nothing specific about this case. They didn't say she held a grudge against the defendant. She had some reason to lie against this defendant. They said she lied to get attention. Well, if she lies to get attention, then the allegation is she is a child who lies to get attention.
Was that argument made, or was there evidence that she lied in other circumstances to get attention?
No, there wasn't evidence that she lied in other circumstances to get attention. What I'm saying is that when you stand up there and say to the jury, this child is lying. She lies to get attention. She loved the attention she was getting in this case.
And now he said, repeating a lie doesn't make it true. You will hear all these different versions because every time she's told someone the story has changed. What didn't change was the attention she got for telling the story, the excitement. Then he went on, you will hear testimony that as a result of this disclosure, police officers came to see her, social workers came to see her, she went to court, she met with victim witness people, she met with district attorneys. You will hear that she received a great deal of attention for this disclosure. Is that what we're talking about?
That's what we're talking about. And we're talking about the initial lie. I mean, they're saying that she initially lied to get attention.
So you think that goes to her character?
What if he had said she lied because she wanted to get this man out of her life because her real, take a thousand different factual situations. She lied to get this man out of her mother's life so her mother could be with her real father.
There you've got something that's case specific. There you've got something, say, this child has a motive to lie this particular time.
That's the line that you draw. So if it's case specific, you'd say it's not an attack on credibility, and therefore cannot be buttressed by supporting witnesses. But if it is a general attack on credibility, such as here, i.e., you're lying not to get dad out of stepfather out of the life, but you're lying because you're getting attention, or you are a congenital liar, or anything like that, that can be buttressed.
Or in another case that I think is wrongly decided, they say the sexual assault victim is lying to get money.
Now, do you think that's...
Well, if you're lying to get money, doesn't that really say you have a poor character? You're someone who lies to get money, and you'd lie against this defendant to get money. Uh-huh. I mean, it doesn't say you have a grudge against this particular defendant. There's nothing case-specific. There's nothing that ties it to this case.
So you would say then, I think, that the language of Anderson is needs clarification.
I do. I think Anderson is really wrong because it's too simplistic. It draws a line at intentional lying. And people can intentionally lie for a case-specific reason. So I can see that. I want to be clear that in my brief, I think Anderson is a justifiable rule only because of the relative, soft nature of what we're dealing with here.
Well, as I wrote down defense counsel's comment, and as I wrote down yours, or started to write down yours, they were the same. It seems to me you both agree that the only time you can bring in this evidence is if there's a general attack on truthfulness, character truthfulness. But if it's an attack on the case specific, you can't. That's your position.
That's my position, and
your position is here, it's a general attack.
Yes.
On truthfulness. Now, I assume that the judge makes the decision whether it's specific or general. I'm shorthanding this.
Yes, he did.
And it's a discretionary decision.
Yes.
And that the review is erroneous exercise of discretion.
Yes. As it is with all evidentiary rulings.
And if there was error here, you'd think it's harmless.
I do. If this wasn't an attack on her general character, if they weren't saying that she is generally a liar who lies to get attention, and this is an example of it, then why would it be harmful for the prosecution to put on testimony that she's generally truthful? I mean, if they aren't attacking her general character for truthfulness, they're not saying she's generally a child who lies, then testimony saying that she's generally truthful doesn't really hurt their case. Because they come back and they say, well, there's a case-specific reason. There's a reason that she's lying in this case.
Counsel,
but there isn't a case.
When it's a one-on-one case, any witness that's going to testify, I understand theoretically your argument makes a lot of sense. Practically, it makes no sense to me at all. And regardless of whether it's the state or the defense doing it, you have a one-on-one witness. The jury has to decide whether the state is satisfied and beyond a reasonable doubt that one witness is being truthful and one is not. Any witnesses that are going to come up and say this witness is generally a truthful person is going to be helpful to the one who's trying to prove that point. And the state, theoretically, the jury, if you're being untruthful here but generally you're truthful, it doesn't matter. But as a practical matter, it certainly has impact.
Well, I'm not trying to be theoretical at all. I'm really trying to be very practical.
Do you think jurors would draw the distinction that you're making in listening? If they have a witness, a character witness that they truly respect, come up and say, generally, this witness, my opinion of this person is this is a truthful person, that's not going to have an impact? Whether it's harmless or not is another question, but to say it has no impact.
Here's what I'm saying. As a practical matter in this case, the defense wanted the jurors to believe that this child was an untrustworthy child. As a practical matter, that's what they wanted. That's why they didn't want the supportive character evidence, because they didn't have anything they could point to give her a motive to lie against this particular defendant. They wanted the jury to think that she's the kind of child who lies to get attention. That was what they needed. And so that's why the evidence was relevant in this case. That's what I'm saying. So when it matters in a case, when they're really attacking general character, this evidence shouldn't come in.
Counsel, I could just ask you one question. I gather you think Anderson has to be prepared, would you adopt the Dring test, the test in the Dring case?
No, I think that this is a trick. I didn't read a single case from any jurisdiction, and I read dozens, that does a good job of explaining the difference between a case-specific attack and a general attack. And it is a great opportunity to contribute to
jurisdiction. Thank you very much, Mr. Mr. Gordon.
Thank you.
The reason Mr. Lunston doesn't find help in other jurisdictions is because this is the time and this is the type of case where this court has to help us. Dring provides us with something. It's better than what Anderson has provided. Anderson has simply provided conflict. Anderson has provided great confusion, if anything. And what concerns me is, more than anything else, is the statement that Mr. Lunston made when he says, the attack is not with evidence. The attack is how you question the witness. And it goes back to what the testing procedure is in Anderson. And the testing procedure is one that the ceiling is so low that all you have to do is be an aggressive cross-examiner, like I said before, pointing a finger, using tone, and under those circumstances, based on the test in Anderson, that would be a sufficient basis under the circumstances.
I think you might be arguing, making arguments you don't need to make. I think Mr. Lunston has conceded that Anderson is at best simplistic and maybe at worst wrong. He's suggesting to this court that we take a look at this in a little bit different manner, with a bit more precision. What do you think about Mr. Lunston's approach here?
Well, Mr. Lunston's approach, I thought I was reading part of my brief when I was listening to Mr. Lunston argue now orally. And the reason I say that is because what he's asking us to do, what he's asking you to do, what he's asking all of us to hear out now is that we look to the general character information versus the case-specific information. And the best case in this country at this time is U.S. versus Dring. It provides us with at least a template of what we should use. But before we even go into whether or not the trial court abused its discretion, this court first has to make a determination based on the standard of review dealing with the law. This